Welcome to the Sports Pro Podcast with Sports Pro editor Owen Connolly, getting inside the sports industry and recording it on audio.
Hello, Wembley, and hi, everyone at home. Welcome to the Sports Pro Podcast Live. Joining me as ever is Sports Pro Deputy Editor Adam Nelson. Hi, Adam.
Hello, Wembley.
Back with us, Matt Slater from the Press Association. Hi, Matt.
Hello. Oh, too loud. It's inevitable.
Wouldn't be the Sports Pro Podcast without some audio difficulties. And joining us for the first time is... Now, where do we start with this? Former England women's cricketer, Test Match Special Commentator and Surrey Director of Women's Cricket, Ebony Rainford-Brent. Hi, Ebony.
Hello. Well, good to be here. And to be able to say hello, Wembley, is quite cool, isn't it?
How's everybody feeling? 2 days of Sports Pro Live in the can and another successful event, are we saying? Are we waiting for the fallout to...
Well, as ever at these things, I've lived on a diet of carbohydrates and coffee, so I'm feeling pretty good by the end of day two.
Yeah.
It's been good. Yeah, I think so. How do you feel it went?
I haven't seen much of it. I've been kind of buzzing around and I've been up here. But people seem to have enjoyed it. At least the ones who are kind of straggling on to watch us kind of witter away for 20 minutes or so. Ebony, how did you enjoy bringing the whole thing together?
Yeah, I loved it actually. Surprisingly, there was... not surprising, but I wasn't sure how, you know, it would be taken by the audience. But so many people have come up individually and sort of said how much they've enjoyed it and how the whole event felt nice and relaxed, but still the messages came out. I'm somebody who, although I, you know, have very professional hats, I'm also quite a relaxed person. So I enjoyed the atmosphere. It felt, you know, all the professionalism and insight was there, but a nice feel and everyone was quite engaging. So, yeah, I've loved every minute.
There we go. That's what we go for here. Any key moments, Matt? We'll start with you. You opened us up yesterday with Sir Craig Reedy on what's been one of the sports news topic of the year so far, which is, you know, the continuing bumps in the road for the anti-doping bandwagon. Yeah. What did you think of that conversation with Sir Craig?
I think it was definitely. Well, for me, it was probably the biggest story, biggest sports news story of last year. If we sort of pretend that the Olympics isn't a sports news story, so that saga of doping coming back in a very big way, in a sort of the state-sponsored elements of it, the levels of cheating, the espionage elements to it, the you know, swapping whey and putting coffee granules in whey and all this sort of stuff.
I mean, it was just gold remarkable. Blend.
Yeah, and it involved Soviet secret agents, and it was just, you know, dissidents and people possibly being bumped off as well. So it was just a remarkable story, and its repercussions are still being felt because sport reacted to it in very different ways. Without going over old ground, the IOC blinked and didn't. Handle it particularly well, and a relatively strong Russian team went to Rio and did pretty well. The IPC kept them out of the Paralympics, and I think received a lot of kudos for that, as did the IAAF on the athletics side. Now, poor Sir Craig Reedy, as a long-standing IOC member, was very much caught in the middle, and at times it got very personal for him. It appeared to me and many other observers that WADA was being blamed for spoiling the Olympics. They were blamed, I think, perhaps reasonably for letting it happen, and I think that's a good debate. And why, if we give you money and we pay for all these tests and we're ferrying blood and urine around the world, you know, how on earth did this happen? That's a better debate, but the debate got, as I say, more simplistic and nastier than that. It was, why are you telling us now? We're heading to Rio. This is the greatest show on earth. What are you doing? And he had a tough year last year. Yeah. What I would say about Sir Craig now, and I thought it came across very clearly for me, is he very much feels he's through the worst. He's weathered the storm. I thought at times he might quit last year. He hasn't. He started to talk about WADA as we, as in WE, not the other type of we, which he never used to before. I think he's got into anti-doping. I think he's realised that it is an existential threat to sport and the Olympics. And I commend him for that. And I thought we saw a very relaxed Sir Craig Reid yesterday.
Very, very relaxed, very candid as well. I was at the IOC session that day with you when he was unloaded on by various IOC members. And there does seem to be an attitude, and it's something that the anti-doping movement comes up against, that it's inconvenient to admit that athletes are cheating. It's inconvenient to find out, especially, that athletes are cheating. And that's not restricted to Olympic sport. I think, you know, a lot of us will look at certain team sports and suggest maybe not everything is being done to uncover or to reveal what's really going on. Do you think that the other thing that was exposed was kind of a funding gap in doping or anti-doping?
This is a good question. It's undeniable that WADA, World Anti-Doping Agency, in Montreal, are underfunded. We're talking about 70 people who are asked to do more and more all the time. Go uncover unbelievable wrongdoing in Russia. You know, go find out what's going on in China. Go work out what these 30 laboratories around the world are doing. Are they up to the, you know, are they good enough? Are these 200 nations complying with this quite complicated and ever-growing list of banned substances? Is our ban list good enough? You know, they're a sort of science organisation, they're a regulator, they're now increasingly an investigator. And they do this for about £20 million, $30 million. That's £15 million from governments. And let's be honest, that we're talking about a dozen rich governments, maybe 20, 30 rich governments, and the IOC. So WADA is underfunded. Everybody knows that. Anti-doping, if you add up what every sport is doing, what every team does, what every competition does, they spend a lot of money. They collect a lot of urine. They do a lot of blood tests. Is it any good? Don't know. Yeah. You know, do people think sport's that clean at the moment for all the tests that are being done? It's become a huge industry. It's become a huge business. So when sports get angry with anti-doping, they're angry that they spend quite a lot of money on it and these scandals happen that are bad for business. Mm. WADA is at the top of the pile, so should be overseeing this. Yeah, must carry some of the blame. But WADA is underfunded. WADA cannot do its job very well on the money it's been given.
Something that Michael Payne, who's another one of our speakers yesterday, obviously has an extensive level of experience within the Olympic movement as a former marketing director and a consultant to all kinds of organisations within Olympic sport, suggested on Twitter that maybe the answer, particularly to something like the Russian doping regimen that's been uncovered by the McLaren report, is just to issue whacking great fines. You know, 8, 9, 10 figure fines for undermining and corrupting sport. Is that workable?
I don't know if it's workable. It's funny that he said that because he keeps his ear very close to the ground at the IOC, doesn't he? I mean, we know he moves in those circles. He goes to those lunches. I wonder if the big fine is a classic IOC way out of this. And when I went big fine, I'm thinking, what was McLaren fined for spying on Ferrari at F1?
Well, that was actually the... I think that's what he was making reference to.
Well, there you go. Great minds. Now, would Vladimir Putin be up for that? Probably. How much did he spend on Sochi? Loads. Yeah. You know?
So loads is the number.
Yeah. So would he pay a fine of loads to make this go away? Probably. Is that fair? Is that justice? I'd suggest not. I'd suggest that if you cannot individually punish those athletes, which I think is a principle we'd all agree with, that if you've done something wrong, you should be individually punished. If that's going to be too complicated for umpteen reasons, and it's going to be really tricky to prove that every single Russian athlete knew what was... When they swapped their urine for that urine, and when they were asked 6 months before Sochi Olympics to bank something, if that's knowingly guilty, or becomes too hard to prove that it was knowingly guilty, then I think the collective punishment is the only way you can go. But it appears the IOC are still very reluctant to do that. They didn't do that for Rio. They appear to be looking for reasons not to do it for Pyeongchang. So a fine could be the way out.
Ebony, can you offer an athlete's perspective on all of this?
I can remember the days of drugs testing. It was a nightmare, if I'm honest. I have horrendous memories of being at training and, you know, the police. It's like the police swoop in, basically. But, you know, and I suppose cricket's, a different sport just in the sense that I don't think you'd get the same sort of gains you would in a lot of athletics in the same sort of disciplines like we've seen with the Russians. But also, you know, I know that there was a good culture in cricket, particularly, you know, in women's cricket as well. But I think that actually when you're amateur and you know, a lot of Olympic sports as well, you know, a lot of people get funding, but they're still at a very baseline level. You almost think there's no point in you putting in all that effort to mess yourself up. And, you know, you see a lot of athletes quite conscious because they're sacrificing so much. They're sacrificing work opportunities, money and all of that sort of stuff to do it. So, you know, from my perspective, you know, it was always something I was very worried about. And, you know, I've spent years as well. Like, I've had injuries where you have to go and get special TUE forms and all these different sort of things. And you're nervous that you don't want to take the treatment because you don't want to put yourself in a bad position. So, I mean, what we heard last year was just outrageous for me. And I think, you know, I'm all for going in hard because you want a clean sport as possible. And, you know, there's also that side. There's also, you know, cricket's biggest problem at the moment is all about, you know, not gambling, but, you know, money issues. And so many people have been done there. So, yeah, for me, it's about closing that down.
Yeah. I mean, cricket doesn't have a spotless reputation when it comes to anti-doping. And in particular, in common with a lot of sports outside that kind of individual sports mindset, has a tendency of going, well, you know, how much better can you really get? But of course, in the T20 era, there are huge advantages that you can get from taking certain performance enhancing drugs.
Yeah, and a good example of that at the moment is Andre Russell, who's the West Indian cricketer who, you know, he makes a lot of money, millions going around the different leagues and playing. And, you know, these balls are going miles out the ground and the guys are hitting them further and further and further. You know, like you say, cricket isn't clean. If you can get to the top of your game, just get a bigger bat. You know, you don't have to go and chuck stuff in your body. Just get a bigger bat and clear the legs and clear the ropes. But it is an issue for cricket, and sport just needs to look at finding ways to deal with that.
That can only be so much bigger now, though, with the MCC.
Yeah, race. MCC are cashing in, aren't they, on all these rules?
Adam, let's move the conversation on. What was one of your key moments of the last couple of days?
Well, as you were saying earlier, the thing about working on these events is that we don't really get to see any of the panels apart from the ones that we're moderating. So, I'd say today I was in a panel with a guy called Mike Moffo, who worked on President Obama's campaigns in 2007 and 2011?
2008 and 2012.
Yeah, but the years that he was working on the campaigns.
Sure.
Yeah. And his kind of take on the use of data in sport and the way it's lagging behind, not necessarily politics, but certain other sectors of society, in that our use of data at the moment is just get it out there, throw data at people, see what they do with it. And the way that we need to be much more clever about the way that we tell stories using that data, because fans at the moment are just being overwhelmed by numbers being thrown at them. And I thought that was really interesting, combining that with the panels on broadcast that we've seen, with broadcasters talking about how they're looking for new ways to engage fans on second screens, and that hasn't necessarily taken off in the way that some of them expected it would have done by this point.
Yeah, Ebony, how much in your director of cricket at Surrey role, obviously you're involved with the Surrey Stars, new franchise, new league, and the Kia Super League, trying to bring in new fans to a sport that they might not be familiar with, particularly on the women's side. How much contact do you have with that kind of thinking, with big data and so on?
Try and keep cricket as simple as possible. I think it's in danger sometimes of overcomplicating it. And you're right, you know, we're trying to engage a new audience, and I think you've just got to keep the key headlines and you've got to keep things as simple as possible. I mean, I actually wanted to be in that session because, you know, when you read down, I thought it would be interesting to see how you can shape the numbers to get the most impact. So hopefully you can give me some insight and I'll chew your brain on that later. But I think from a cricket's perspective, you know, that they are important and you've got to get things out there, but it's also about not overwhelming your audience. Mm.
And Adam, from your point of view, we've talked a lot about personalisation of the viewer experience and so on. How far down the road do you expect that that's going to go?
Well, I thought it was interesting today, the panel where we had OBS and Levin talking about their different varying strategies in different regions and how their plan at the moment is to go global, to go local, particularly the Olympic Channel. They're tailoring a lot of content to local things in order that brings it back to this kind of global story around the Olympics. And I think that's something that sport really can't lose. There was one, I can't remember who it was, talking about it today, but it's about football fans tuning in and making sure that they see their team at the top of everything that they tune into, which I'm not necessarily sure is a long-term good idea, because the whole joy of a season-long narrative of the Premier League is that it's not just about one team, it's about all 20 teams, and they're all equally important. So if every time you click onto your TV, it's showing you Manchester United-related content, you're missing out on the story that football provides. And I think that's the same across sport. So I'm a little bit wary of personalised broadcast content. I think in the short term I can see why it looks good, given the way that social networking is going and things like that. But I think long term, is that the best way for sport to maintain an audience?
Yeah, it's the whole echo chamber thing again, isn't it? And you know, the idea of sport being something that's universal and that can bring together two people who have completely different viewpoints, perhaps completely different background, you know, the old, you know, talking to a cab driver about what football team you support and all of that kind of stuff goes away when you don't know anything about the other one.
Yeah, and just to offer a bit of perspective on that, I have a younger brother who has just started secondary school and he claims to be a Liverpool fan, but he's, you know, he's one of these kids who has a T-shirt of the top team in every European soccer league, but he only knows about those teams. It's not like he doesn't follow football, he just happens to enjoy those teams, and I don't know whether that is going to make him a football fan for life, because as soon as those teams don't do so well, or that, you know, something happens, whereas I think the fans who stay with football and stay with sport for life are the ones who really have a connection with the story that sport is trying to tell across all the teams, and that was echoed by what Sean Harvey was saying yesterday in the panel that I did there, the way they're trying to engage Football League fans around the world by telling the Football League story so that Leeds United is as on the same level as Bury, and there's no difference between in the way they treat a fan, regardless of what level their team is at.
Okay. There's a few of you have stuck around with us here in the plenary room at Wembley in the Great Hall. Do any of you have any questions, or any of you want to contribute in any way or pick out a key moment? I hope somebody does, because otherwise we're going to have to edit all of this out to make me look slightly less daft. Well, we actually have a series of questions that people submitted before Sports Pro Live when they registered to join us here. With the emergence of social media, Adam, are we likely to see more live sports in front of the paywall? And what does that mean for pay operators, whether TV or OTT? Interesting discussion in the light of everything that's been going on. And again, it's coming back around to cricket, Ebony, but with the ECB discussions of their new T20 competition that they have unveiled their plans for this week. But do you see that as being the direction of travel towards more stuff being available for free away from the kind of Premier League elite stuff?
I'm not convinced. I think we may be moving towards more and more paywalls for the larger rights packages. You know, in order to watch an entire, say, season of T20, but we may get more short-form free content, which is kind of the model that's emerging at the moment, and I don't see that changing, to be honest. I think people will always have an appetite to pay for the big package, and they may be happy to feed on the free scraps that are being handed out by the big rights holders or the broadcasters. I'm not convinced that we're going to that we're in a position at the moment where any rights holder or any broadcaster can afford to give things away for free.
Oh, and I think we got a question from the floor.
Oh, we have.
Hey, so I was interested in the panel's opinion. In-seat entertainment seems to be the way forward, especially in the States, with this propensity for clubs to make match days more exciting, particularly I'm speaking about football. What do you think the prospects are for the media companies to release the ability for clubs to play back replays direct to people's phones, even if it was a limit of a maximum of 4 minutes of highlights within a walled garden of the stadium? I think it's just so important.
It's interesting. We have this conversation with people quite often about what the in-venue experience of the future is going to be like. And quite often what they will talk about is just the technological capacity, whether that's Wi-Fi or mobile connectivity or whatever. That's one thing that's kind of holding that back from happening, I suppose. It's certainly something that some venue operators, some rights holders would like to do. There are others who are concerned about the idea of putting a film, a veneer between the spectator and the event that's actually happening in the stadium. The whole thing of not participating in a live event in the same way because you are constantly interacting with a screen. So I guess there's different schools of thought on that. It's something that's theoretically possible. There are other things that come into it as well. I don't know. Ebony, what do you think?
Yeah, and I'm just only taking cricket because that's my main sport, but I find whenever I'm sat in the stadium, I know that, for example, the ICC are having the Champions Trophy here this summer, so all the grounds are making sure they're investing in their Wi-Fi and etc. And even though that's all been in place for a long time, I still find as a fan, whenever I'm sat in the crowd and I try and get on the Wi-Fi or try and get my 3G, it just doesn't seem to operate very quickly. And I don't know if it's... and that's not just, one ground. I find that there seems to be a bit of a challenge. So I think there's a barrier, one, with technology that when it catches up, yes, it'll be in place. But I still think there's some issues there when you've got such large audiences. Also, I suppose when you're there, you want to connect with the game. And I don't know if it feels a little bit wrong. Just my, personal views, but it might feel a bit wrong to be there. It is important to have your big screens in terms of your replays and stuff like that. I find that really important, but I'm not sure if I'd want to. It's a bit like when you go to dinner with your mates and you put your phone on the table. I don't know, something feels wrong, and we all do it, but it's when you check it kind of breaks that connection with the live sport. But that's my personal opinion.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I'm coming across, I keep just rejecting all these ideas of technology changing the way that we watch sport.
You are, but from Yorkshire,
I think that you mentioned having limits on the amount of replays that you could show. I don't know who would kind of judge if there's a football match where something, all the action happens after the 85th minute and you've used up your 4 minutes of allotted replays already. Let's assume the technology is fine to make it work. Even in practical terms, I don't know how it would happen. I would say, though, that there are some sports that really benefit from it. I was at the snooker for the first time in January and buying a little £10 earpiece that I could listen to the commentary while the game was being played was really beneficial, because snooker's played at quite a slow pace and it's good to have someone sort of talking you through it. So I think that if you bring that to a larger scale, there are sports that benefit from those kind of technological... Golf as well, absolutely, and cricket is one of them. I just worry a sport like rugby or football or most of the American sports, which depend on atmosphere within the stadium, if you've got minutes at a time of the game where people are looking at their phones rather than the pitch, I think that detracts a little bit from the whole point of going to live sport.
I agree. I'm a complete Luddite. If I've paid a ticket to go see some sport, I want to watch the sport. I let the people at home mess around with their second screens. I'll watch what's going on in front of me. Thank you very much.
The danger is, though, we could all be out slightly of touch, as in you talk to the younger generation who have grown up with a mobile in their hand. I wonder if, you look forward in 10 years' time and we're all dinosaurs, really. Not saying that we are, but we could be.
There's an interesting dynamic as well that in football stadiums, you are not allowed to see, or the fan in the venue is not allowed to see contentious decisions. The fan at home can can see them, but I think it's a kind of crowd control kind of measure. Of course, that might now change because there is the introduction as of the last few weeks, and of course Sean Harvey talks about it here, being a possibility in the EFL Cup next year, of video assistant referees who will be reviewing these contentious decisions, and it would make very little sense if they weren't then able to relay them to fans in the stadium. But I'm sure very little sense is maybe made. I don't know. Okay, well, we had this morning opening up for us David Richardson of the ICC. Had some very interesting things to say. Obviously, the ICC seems to be in a constant state of flux, and international cricket seems to be in a constant state of negotiation with itself. But he certainly struck a tone of being interested in pushing the boundaries, to coin a phrase, and making cricket into a global sport, and actually challenging some of these things that have been mainstays of the sport, things like status and competition structure and so on. We've heard this kind of thing before, but Ebony, what was your response to that session?
My favourite session, I'm just going to compare it, of the whole couple of days, was the One Championship, and just hearing his expansion of the MMA throughout Asia. And what struck me was the values that they approached it with, and the storylines and all those sort of things. And I'm getting a nod over there, because I know, he spoke with a lot of excitement. So one thing that showed me is it doesn't matter whether there's a crowded market, if you've got the right product and you place it right, there are audiences. And I think with cricket, especially, knowing about America is a fantastic opportunity, China, there's room to grow the game. I think cricket... we're sometimes slow to adapt. I mean, if you think about T20 when it first came out, again, it took us a long time to realise there needed to be a quicker product. So I think eventually we're going to move in the right direction, but I think there are some times we're quite slow. Ireland, for example, is a team that you'd expect to have moved on over the last 10 years and be moving towards test status quicker, and they're not. So T20 is a fantastic proposition, and I think you see the success of IPL and Big Bash in cricketing countries. But I just think if we can take some lessons from, Chatri and his talk on One Championship to look at the ways we can grow the game.
Mm. Matt?
Well, like Ebony, I'm going to answer your question by talking about another session first. Because
we've had a lot of great stuff here.
No, you're absolutely right. This morning was great, and I'm still catching up. I'm still writing stories about this morning, which is why I was playing with my phone, which obviously makes a nonsense of my last answer. But... the session after Dave Richardson's was, I think it was Ed Warner, and talking about kind of national governing bodies, which is very timely stuff. Perhaps GB's obsession with medals. Is it time maybe to change that model? Should we be thinking about participation? Governance again, British cycling. There was very, very kind of newsworthy topics. And I think Dave Richardson was fantastic as well. I mean, I was taking notes, and there are about half a dozen sort of possible stories there. He's talking about growing the women's game. Again, I would argue about time, but it was kind of radical stuff. He was saying, let's go from 10% of all cricket played to 30, 40 in 5 years. Again, there was a nice concert. There was a nice link with the Olympics that, much maligned. We were talking about the problems they had around Russian doping last year. It is still a fantastic way to grow your sport. And I know cricket have looked quite jealously and perhaps... kicking themselves, they let rugby go first with the rugby sevens. Now, T20 looks pretty suited to the Olympics to me. You could argue that perhaps it's still a bit centred on the British Empire, but, the Olympics would soon sort that out. So I thought that was really, really interesting. He seems quite optimistic that he can persuade the various parts of the cricket world that it is worth it. Whether they'll have room in 2024, because there are limits on the number of athletes you can have. Whether Paris wants to host cricket or LA, I don't know. But he was talking about American cricket, of course. There's a big growth market for there if they can get that sorted. So I think he spoke on lots of topics, and I found him fascinating. Then we had Ed Warner with his sort of governance session, sort of lobbing grenades out there about... the rest of the British Olympic family being tarred with the British cycling brush. So it was a lively morning.
Adam. Do you have any reaction to some of those suggestions about the expansion of what is by headcount apparently the world's second most popular sport, but you would not know it because it barely makes a dent in so many markets. It's an international sport, but by no means a global one.
Well, as I missed those two panels this morning, I feel like my contribution is going to be limited. I think 2020, I think of all the kind of new formats that various sports have tried out, 2020 is the only one that's proved itself to be sticky, and for a very good reason. It is a really great distillation of what makes cricket special. And in a sense, might be controversial, but I think it's kind of made one-day cricket slightly redundant in that the aim of one day is to have a speeded-up version of Test cricket, and then 2020 does everything that does, but in 3 hours. And I can see, I could see 2020 breaking the American market if they get their marketing strategy right, if they take it to the right markets in America where they've got, mentioned Los Angeles, you know, there's fantastic opportunities there to use baseball stadiums to play cricket at the Olympics. And I think that with a little bit of luck and the right strategy, 2020 could take cricket outside the Commonwealth and the former empire.
It's an interesting point you bring up about the USA, because there have been 2020 games played there. The Caribbean Premier League is being played there. There was a tournament involving some pretty high-profile stars played in Hong Kong a couple of months ago. Ultimately, what T20 can do and what the franchise model can do is just grow the game on its own terms. And that ultimately, I guess, it brings me to a question about the role of governing bodies and the role of sports administrators. If we get to a point where other people can take sports forward, what does their response need to be, Matt?
Well, listening to everything that Dave Richardson was talking about, because whilst he was very exciting about T20 and women's cricket and the Olympics, and it was more, and I was thinking, right, because I was just talking to ECB a couple of weeks ago, they were talking about our domestic T20, more. What are we adding months to the year here? Have we invented a time machine? What's going to happen here? Are we going to sort of clone players? Because he had another lovely idea, which was to have a sort of two-yearly test championship series, which I know we've talked about, and there'd be a final at Lord's in the English summer. I was thinking, brilliant. This is great, you know, for people like me that like slow things and concentrating on what's happening in front of me. Great. Only afterwards did he sort of admit, yeah, scheduling is going to be hard. And it does mean compromises. It does mean leadership to sort of say, look, if we kind of agree that the Olympics is a good idea, the women's cricket's a good idea, that T20 is a good idea, and perhaps having some sort of meaningful test series is a good idea, it means you're going to have to do a bit less of that and that, and maybe drop that completely. Now, sometimes that's tough.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, there's two points I want to make here. Is one, just following up on your point, you know, for example, this new domestic league, we're still going to have another T20 league running underneath it, the 50 over the 40. I mean, it is too much, and someone needs to find a way to tidy that up. The last thing I'll say about the kind of taking the game outside to America, one of the games that was played, it might have been sort of the back end of last year, which had Tendulkar, and they got some legends out. One thing that they did which really wound me up is the ticket price was very, very high. And there's a lot of Asian people that were living in that community where they hosted the game. And so it was already existing fans who were desperate to see a Tendulkar turnout that paid for it. And, you know, I remember I was part of an interview panel with the guy who was kind of behind the business of it. And there was a question, you know, are you really growing the game, or are you just taking it to a kind of ready-made audience in there? And that's one thing I do want to see, you know. One thing Australia have done really well with the Big Bash, with so much free-to-air, the ticket prices, they actually have engaged new audiences. And I'm not convinced if we go down those sorts of models that will help the game grow globally.
Just in order to tie this into another panel that we've had at Sports Pro Live, because it's supposed to be a review, that comes back to what I was talking about with Hannes Jagerhofer from the Beach Majors yesterday. He's created this beach volleyball series in which 90% of the tickets are free, and they let people in for free with the intention that their revenue is based on sponsorship and broadcast and things like that, so they can allow the series to grow because people want to come and be part of the atmosphere, and then they make money from VIPs and things like that. But if you're trying to break cricket or any sport into a new territory, I think that is a model to look at and to observe, that you have to create a product. It's not just about the sport, it's about the whole product that people are going to want to come to these events, and it has to be if not free, then as close to free as you can make it, so that people don't feel like they're spending half their paycheck on going, or as you say, it's not just attracting existing fans who just want to see the big names.
Okay, any final thoughts, guys, because I think we're coming to the end of our time here.
I have no final thoughts.
Adam?
I have no final thoughts.
I have about 10, but I'm going to leave them for another day.
Okay, well, that means we've probably covered everything. So a successful couple of days. Thank you for listening if you're not at Wembley. Thank you for joining us if you are. It's been a great couple of days. Thank you to Matt Slater.
Thanks for having me.
To Adam Nelson.
Thank you.
And thank you for a fantastic stint, Ebony Broom from Brent.
Thank you very much. It's been brilliant.
Thanks, guys.